Today on the Brian Lehrer Show, New York State has a budget deal that includes tighter controls on state legislators and teachers, but no DREAM Act, no minimum wage increase, no post-Eric Garner criminal justice reform. We will get details. Also today, the Bo Bergdahl trial, the complicated case of an American accused of deserting the military in Afghanistan. Manhattan Borough President Gail Brewer today on her bill to keep small businesses from being replaced by more banks, more drugstores, more Dunkin' Donuts, and a man and a woman who decided not to have children compare notes. But first, tomorrow night is the deadline for the long-awaited Iran nuclear weapons agreement with the U.S. and five other world powers. It comes as the Middle East is increasingly embroiled in non-nuclear wars that the Obama administration is mostly trying to stay out of to the largest extent possible. Slate magazine's War Stories columnist Fred Kaplan asks in his latest article, is Obama being shrewd or naive? We'll ask Fred Kaplan in a minute. We know what House Speaker John Boehner thinks.
The world is starving for American leadership. But America has an anti-war president. We have no strategy, overarching strategy, to deal with the growing terrorist threat.
John Boehner, but on ABC This Week with George Stephanopoulos yesterday, White House spokesman Josh Earnest responded.
Well, look, George, I'd simply say that if John Boehner thinks that U.S. troops should be on the ground in Yemen fighting the Houthis, or that we should reoccupy Iraq, or that the United States should bomb Iran to prevent them from obtaining a nuclear weapon, then he should have the courage of his convictions to actually say so. The fact is the president at every turn has taken steps by building the international community's support for policies that actually are in the best interest of the United States. And whether that's bringing the international community to the negotiating table to prevent Iran from obtaining a nuclear weapon, or building a coalition of more than 60 countries, including a large number of Arab countries, to launch airstrikes against ISIL to try to eliminate the extremist threat that exists in the Middle East. These are steps that the president has taken consistent with our national interests, and he does not believe it is in the best interest of the United States to commit more U.S. ground troops to a large-scale ground combat operation in Iraq or in Syria, that if we work with our international partners, we can do a better job of actually protecting the interests of the United States.
Isn't it great that the White House has a spokesman now named Earnest? Well, he seemed pretty sincere there in making the president's case for his military approach to the Middle East. What should the U.S. be doing in the new war in Yemen, both an al-Qaeda and Iranian stronghold? How about Iraq, where our latest bombing campaign against ISIS might benefit Iran? And should all of this cause the United States to postpone any nuclear deal? Joining us now is Slate War Stories columnist Fred Kaplan. He is also the author of The Insurgents, David Petraeus, and the Plot to Change the American Way of War. Hi, Fred. Welcome back to WNYC.
Hi. Thanks for having me on.
First, can you help us understand this war in Yemen? It's al-Qaeda versus Iranian-backed rebels versus a Saudi Arabia-backed president?
Yeah. You know, I think it's worthwhile to step back a little bit. You know, you can get really lost in the weeds, and there are a lot of weeds, which is kind of strange for a desert, but it's a very strange place these days. You know, you go back, and this sounds a little absurd, but stick with me for a minute. You go back to the end of World War One. The Ottoman Empire, which used to control all of this land, has evaporated, and the British and French move in and draw artificial borders in the sand, and they put their own people in charge. And the idea of this is to suppress the tribal minorities and to open up the oil and other things to the British and French. Okay, this ends at the end of World War II, when British and France lay in ruin. They've won, but they're in horrible shape. The old colonial powers are declaring independence. But then the Cold War starts, and the area gets divided up again to American allies and Soviet allies. All this time, all of these tribal, sectarian, ethnic conflicts, which have been raging for centuries, have been suppressed by wider conflicts. The Cold War ends, and slowly, gradually, the superpower condominium is lifted and these conflicts reemerge. They are then accelerated by the invasion of Iraq. There used to be this kind of balance between Iran and Iraq. That's ended. The Sunni powers in Iraq are vanquished by the U.S. military mainly. The Shiites take over. Iran exerts a great influence on them. The other Sunni countries, Egypt, Saudi Arabia, Jordan, start going nuts. New completely independent entities start to grow up, Al-Qaeda, the Houthis, and so forth. In other words, the artificial borders that were created at the end of World War I are shifting in the sands. They are revealing their artifice, and, you know, it could take decades, even centuries, for some new stability to form. Now, that, I think, that is the context in which all of these other conflicts should be viewed, and it helps explain why everything, at least according to the framework that we're used to viewing the world in, you know, there's us with the good guys and the other, the bad guys with the bad guys, is no longer a relevant way of looking at things.
So does this mean the United States and the West should kind of stay out of it and say, huh, sorry, I guess we should never have tried to draw the borders of another part of the world in the first place. You go work it out, Saudis and Iranians and insurgent groups springing up.
That is the great fantasy. I mean, most Middle East scholars and even officials I know wish that that were easier to do than it is, because, I mean, this is an uncontrollable situation. But, you know, you have a few things going on in that region. You've got oil. You've got the Straits of Hormuz. You know, you've got these straits through which oil passes. You've got Israel. It's on the border with everything that could make Russia blow up. You've got... This is where so many wars have started, and, you know, it's impossible for the United States or just about any other country to isolate itself from the rest of the world. So I'm afraid that we have no choice but to at least stay in and try to play a mediating role if such a thing is possible.
Well, I want to get back to that big picture question. It all leaves me feeling pretty isolationist these days, and I want to get your own take. But... In Yemen, Saudi Arabia leading a military invasion to stave off the Iranian-backed rebels. The U.S. is backing the Saudis in that. Why are we throwing in with them?
Well, we're throwing in, first of all, we're not quite throwing in. I mean, we're doing about as little as can be done while still offering our unique capabilities. Our unique capabilities in this case, I mean, it's not trivial. We're basically feeding live drone pictures to the Saudi Air Force so they know where the targets are. But we're not getting into it themselves, and I think that's a good thing. I think the only reason why we're getting into this thing is that the Saudis and the Egyptians and Jordan, they're so bent out of shape thinking that we are throwing our lot in with the Iranians because we're having these nuclear talks with Iran, that I think when they come to us and say, we would like your help with this conflict, it would be bad just to say, no, go get yourself locked in that morass. We're not getting anywhere near it. But I don't think we're going to be doing a lot in Yemen, and you
it's
know.
Just logistical support. And one of the most interesting developments this weekend to me, though not making the biggest headlines, is that the Arab League is now forming a multinational force to fight with the Saudis in Yemen. That's Arab countries acting regionally on their own without relying on Americans to fight their battles for them on the ground, because they're all kind of Sunni and don't like Iran, and they're afraid of Iran expressing its Shiite power. Mm-hmm. Is this new and different, the fact that the Arab League is forming this multinational force to fight a war there in Yemen?
Yeah, they've almost never done it before. It used to be a kind of nonsense organization. It was a kind of a vehicle to express pan-Arab ideology, but they never really felt they had to do anything because they were always under the control of either the United States or Russia anyway. And then during the time when the Israel-Palestinian thing was the leading, at least rhetorical, conflict in the region, they would blame everything that happens on that, and, oh, we can't do anything until the Israel-Palestine crisis is solved. Now they're actually taking steps. You know, I'm always amazed by these, especially Republicans, who go nuts when something like this happens. I mean, haven't we been saying for eons that we want the allies, whoever they happen to be, to step up and do more for their own defense? Well, you know, this is happening, and I don't see anything wrong with it.
Right. And with respect to Iraq, as you point out, we're fighting Sunni ISIS, which can help Shiite Iran expand mm-hmm. its influence there. So is this a contradiction? This is what I kept hearing on the Sunday shows yesterday, and
yeah.
I thought it was really simplistic, just, you know, pointing out contradiction for the sake of pointing out, ooh, this is a contradiction.
Yeah. Well, look,
isn't,
you know,
it just the logic of choosing the lesser of two evils in each situation?
Well, in that case, you're right. I mean, do people remember World War II when Churchill and Roosevelt teamed up with Stalin to defeat Hitler? They weren't becoming communist, you know. They just decided that Hitler was a much more dangerous force in the world at that time than Stalin. In the meantime, Hitler was going after Stalin as well, so there was a converging motive. You know, if some of these guys had been around then saying, oh, no, we can't team up with the Soviet Union because they're communists,
right,
and they're just as bad as Nazis,
right,
then what would have happened is that we both would have lost to
right.
the Nazis.
But the U.S. is almost refusing to cooperate with an allied force, if we can call it that, that's fighting ISIS, because in Iraq I've been seeing that the U.S. agreed to help get ISIS out of Tikrit by bombing them there, but the U.S. wouldn't do it unless Shiite militia groups, that is, those associated with Iran, but also enemies of ISIS, quit
mm-hmm.
the fight. So why would the U.S. tell probably our most effective ally against ISIS, since the Iraqi government itself is incompetent, their army, why would we tell our most effective ally against ISIS not to fight on our side?
Well, we're trying to build up the Iraqi army, the Iraqi state army, and you know, there is worry elsewhere in the region that, you know, Iraq might become just an Iranian protectorate. And for a while, you know, there was even the commander of the Iranian Quds force, which is like their special operations force, was on the ground with the Shiite militias. So at least the appearance of that had to be
yeah.
tracked back a bit. I think it's mainly theater, though. I mean, look, there's only so much that a president can say about this sort of thing. But if Iraq is going to become a viable state of any sort, it's right on the border with Iran. It is led by a Shiite. It's almost impossible to imagine that Iran is not going to have disproportionate influence
on
Iraq.
And beyond that, this was one of the basic facts of the Iraq war in the Bush administration that made it, one, such a mistake in many people's eyes, but also that never got into the popular discussion very much. Saddam Hussein was a bad guy, partly because he was a Sunni dictator ruling over a majority Shiite country. Once we intervened to help set up majority rule, the Shiites would gain power, and their next-door neighbor, Shiite Iran, would become a gigantic ally and influence. Bush and Cheney invaded Iraq, believing that empowering Iran there was the lesser evil, right?
Well, you know, this is what happens when you look at the world and thinks that everybody really kind of wants to be just like you. Bush had this view, and I think he was sincere in it, that you blow up the dictator, you know, you get rid of the dictator, then freedom sort of spews forth like a manhole being blown up off the street or a volcano erupting. Freedom is the new juice. But that's not really what happens. What happens is that if somebody is holding some manhole down on the natural social forces of a country. When he gets toppled, what happens is that those natural social forces start spewing up. And in this case, it was a gigantic conflict between Shiites and Sunnis, and then with Kurds having a piece of the action too, which we'd forgotten all about because we'd sort of been providing a protectorate for them since the first Gulf War. So there is this notion, we have this idea that everybody in the world, really, if they weren't run by dictators, they would want to be pretty much like us. And the real impediment to Western-style liberty is these awful dictators. And when we get rid of them, then, you know, remember, before the Iraq War, you had otherwise intelligent people like Paul Wolfowitz and, you know, saying, oh, yeah, you know, once this could spread democracy. The example of a victory in Iraq could spread democracy throughout the region. Well, it spread something throughout the region, but it wasn't democracy.
And this gets me back to why I'm thinking isolationist thoughts about the whole thing and thinking Obama is maybe kind of on the right track. You put your article in Slate in the context of a post-Cold War world. Mm-hmm. And I tend to be thinking in those days, in those terms, too, because all those years we backed horrible dictators as long as they backed us in the Cold War against the Soviets and sold us cheap oil. Now we don't need them against the Soviets anymore. And with the U.S. becoming pretty energy independent due to new technologies, whether or not we like fracking, we don't need their oil. And if we're not over there fighting wars and overthrowing heads of state, like we did in Iran, by the way, the next generation won't grow up hating us in the way they do today and forming anti-American governments and terrorist groups, maybe. So Obama trying to ease us out of the region and cultivate things like this Arab League force to like fight their local battles for themselves instead of us, in the big sweep of history, looks to me like the pretty right thing. But I'm no military expert.
Well, no, you're right. But, you know, what happens, it's like the Michael Corleone syndrome. You know, in The Godfather 3, where he's trying to go legit, but they keep pulling me back in. They keep pulling me back in. Well, you know, there's some horrible crisis in the Middle East that has to be dealt with, and so Obama goes in a little bit, and then it leads to something else, and he has to defend against that. It is just a horrible situation, and I've long thought that if a truly charismatic candidate came along who campaigned on a platform that included isolationism, and by that I don't mean Rand Paul because he's less and less charismatic the more that we see him, he or she could have a tremendous appeal. It does, I think. Oh, are you still there?
Yeah, we lost you for a second.
Oh, okay.
But go ahead, you think what?
Well, that a candidate who's charismatic with an isolationist platform could go a long way. And I think that one thing that has not been done by anybody, partly because you have to address some pretty hard realities to talk about it honestly, is someone who comes along and says, okay, here is the American interest in the rest of the world now, and here is why we have to do this, this, and that, and then have a serious debate about it instead of this nonsense, the thing that you opened up with, the exchange, where this, you know, many Republicans have this view that, oh, the way that you solve the crisis in the Middle East is send arms to the Syrian rebels, put 20,000 special forces in Iraq. You know, it's all just sending military troops, and you'd think that they would have learned their lesson by now, but these are fundamentally political issues, many of which deal with conflicts and disputes that we have no idea about, that we just do not understand in the slightest. And getting involved in a thoughtless way is only going to make things worse.
Fred Kaplan from Slate and Stuart from Brooklyn. You're on WNYC. Hello, Stuart.
Yes, hi. Thanks for taking my call. My point is short, but I think sweet. Your commentator seems to be promoting an ideological view from the current administration and ignoring what's worked in the past. What's worked in the past was implemented in both Germany and Japan, where both nations had populations that were varied. What would have worked in Iraq is if we stayed and actually tried to democratize the Middle East instead of pulling out. By pulling out, we left a power void. We did the right thing in Germany. We did the right thing in Japan. both countries had populations that were diverse. And I don't see how our current do the least amount possible policies are going to work in American interests.
Stuart, what more? I'm curious what you think the U.S. could have done to further democratize Iraq. The Bush administration and then a little bit Obama tried to do that for the 10 years after the initial invasion, and it kept, you know, it drifted back into the really bad Maliki government, which became like a factionalized, technically elected, but, you know, not exactly Jeffersonian democracy kind of thing. What more could we have done by keeping the residual force? They were talking about maybe 15,000 boots on the ground. How would that have democratized Iraq further?
Well, that's a good question, and the question actually supports my point. We're still, to this day, in Germany, and we're still, to this day, in Japan. It takes decades to democratize nations that were formed dictatorships. We did not stay in Iraq. We pulled out way too fast, and we did it based on ideological principles instead of following a specific long-term strategy.
Stuart, thank you very much. What do you think,
Brian,
about...
Let me just say two things here. Yeah. First, Germany and Japan were not exactly highly varied countries.
Right.
They're two of the
most
homogeneous. Second, we declared war on both of those places and destroyed them. It was a total surrender. Their systems were completely destroyed. Third, and this I've said this a zillion times, and people still don't remember this, the decision to pull all U.S. forces out of Iraq was made in 2008 by the Bush administration. We signed a status of forces agreement with Iraq, which said that in exchange for continuing to have forces there at the moment, that by the end of 2011, all U.S. forces shall be pulled out of Iraqi air, land, and sea. Now, this had a three-year expiration, which is why we can put forces in there now, but... You know, this is the kind of ridiculous historical analogies and lack of memory of anything that happened, not just 100 years ago, but 3 years ago.
But then there were weren't there negotiations that involved Obama there? And John McCain brings this up over and over again, where
there was
the possibility of a residual force.
Yeah,
but Obama wouldn't leave them there because Iraq wouldn't exempt them from local prosecution if they committed crimes.
Well, we do have that as part of a status of forces agreement in every country where the U.S. has troops. Also, the status of forces agreement said that it can be revised only by a vote by the Iraqi parliament. And the Iraqi parliament just was not going to vote at that time to leave any U.S. forces.
Yeah,
and it is true that Obama tried to have – he did have negotiations, and in fact he sent someone named Brett McGurk, who had been Bush's chief person on Iraq, his chief aide in the National Security Council – on Iraqi affairs. There was a genuine effort, but it just wasn't going to happen.
So
there was no ideological bent to take... And look, we had 100,000 troops in Iraq for a while, and democracy didn't happen. If we had left another 5,000, 10,000, that's not going to change the complexion of an entire country.
David in Manhattan wants to critique the way we're using the word isolationism. David, you're on WNYC. Hi.
Thank you. Isolationism doesn't express the alternative between being militarily involved and fighting wars on the one hand and doing nothing on the other. The United States has had a policy of engagement with the Middle East, you know, at all times except during the liberation of Kuwait in 1991, and yet we certainly can't be accused of having been isolationists towards the Middle East, and our policy of intervening militarily has not been a great success.
I think that I agree. This is an excellent corrective to simplistic dialogue.
David, thank you. So how does all this chaos, including Iran expressing its power in these land wars, affect the nuclear deal deadline tomorrow night? If I'm not mistaken, your friend, I say in quotes, David Petraeus,
my friend,
who you recently published a book about, I think he got out there recently and said, no, 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 you're focusing on the wrong thing if you're going to talk about ISIS, ISIS, ISIS. The real threat is Iran.
Well, he sees Iran as the main threat to the stability of Iraq. But in terms of the nuclear agreements, I think the two really don't have a lot to do with each other, or they shouldn't. I mean, notice, we're in terrible relationship with Russia right now, and yet the Russian ambassador, or the Russian foreign minister, is still very much involved in these talks. There is an interest, a shared mutual interest, in trying to get some kind of deal with Iran on nuclear weapons, on the development of their nuclear program, and on the possible suspension or lifting of sanctions that supersedes any of these sectarian ideological concerns. If these talks do not succeed, it will not be because U.S. is bombing to Crete right now. It will be because they were unable to resolve their differences on a few crucial issues.
But just to inoculate people, if that's the right word, about, you know, from what they're going to hear in the media over and over again the rest of today and tomorrow, with this deadline tomorrow night for the Iran nuclear deal. I guess they could decide to postpone it, but at least at the moment the deadline is tomorrow night.
It's a U.S. deadline.
What many Republicans keep saying is, how could you make a nuclear deal with Iran when Iran is at war with you in Iraq and at war with you in Yemen and expressing their non-nuclear military power all over the place? While Iran is out there making trouble, how can you make a nuclear weapons agreement with them? That's the line that we're hearing, right?
Would they rather have no nuclear agreement, no limit on Iran's nuclear program while they're doing all these mischievous things? I mean, there's no logic here. You know, all during the Cold War, the United States and the Soviet Union negotiated arms control agreements, arms reduction agreements, all of them while the Cold War was still going on, while the two countries had thousands of nuclear warheads aimed at each other's territory.
And while during the Reagan administration and before, the Soviets were making all kinds of trouble all over the world.
Yeah, and while we were fighting in Vietnam against a country that was backed by Soviet weapons sometimes. I mean, these things are separate. There is an interest in doing these kinds of negotiations and trying to put limits on things in exchange for suspensions of other things that affect national security interests that, you know, can go beyond the external crap that's going on elsewhere in the world. It happens all the time. It's happened through history. The level of dialogue that's going on in this country politically about these kinds of issues is as appallingly shallow as it's been since I've been following these issues, and that's I've been doing that for about 40 years. It's really, you know, we should all really be ashamed of our leaders for the level to which this is, and I'm talking about mainly congressional leaders, to which this dialogue has fallen. It's really appalling. It's completely unworthy of a major power.
And with the shame on you moment, we end it with Fred Kaplan, who writes the War Stories column for Slate and wrote the book, The Insurgents, David Petraeus and the Plot to Change the American Way of War. Fred, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Up next, Manhattan Borough President Gail Brewer on her bill to help keep small businesses from being replaced by more banks, more drugstores, more Dunkin' Donuts. Stay with us.